My guest today is the author and essayist Chuck Klosterman. For 20 years, he's written about sports, rock and roll, ethics, movies, TV, pretty much everything we consider popular culture, or for that matter, culture. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Spin, GQ, Esquire, Grantland, and other publications. He's written 9 previous books and joins us now to talk about the newest, titled 10, though that appears on the cover as a Roman numeral, so you may think it's X. Chuck Klosterman, welcome to City Lights.
It is great to be here. Exciting to be in a city with an exploding puppet scene.
No doubt.
I had no idea that was happening.
An international puppet destination.
I wonder what the other big puppet cities are around the globe, like Reykjavik, maybe? I have no idea.
The people at Atlanta Center for Puppetry Arts could tell you, but among other things,
they have
the Jim Henson collection. He bequeathed it to them.
Really?
Yes.
Is he from here or something?
They just
prove that they are the puppet place. Yeah. Well, that's great.
Kermit,
that's amazing.
Blessed us.
Yeah.
But you should, if you can, check it out while you're here. It's one of the destinations. First off, I'd like to ask you about how you feel about being a cultural observer. Is that similar to being a public intellectual?
Well, you know, okay, that's in a way, that's an interesting and kind of a flattering question, because certainly being classified as a public intellectual would be a wonderful thing. We don't really have those in society the way we used to. I mean, you know, if you look back to like the period where it would be like, you know, like William F. Buckley debating Gore Vidal or whatever,
exactly.
That was sort of really an apex in terms of the idea that there were some people whose existence was basically just sort of to comment and almost sort of guide and shape the ideas of a time. Writing about pop culture, I don't know. I mean, I guess in a way it's possible, because at this point, popular culture is really the only culture that America regularly creates. I mean, there is high culture and all that, but for the most part, the role the United States occupies sort of globally in terms of, you know, what we are sort of adding to the mix, it is the popular culture that is the most dominant. So I suppose by virtue of writing about it, you could make that argument. I don't know. In some ways, it seems like if I'm a public intellectual, America is in trouble. But
Okay, David Brooks, and he's one who comes to mind. Salman Rushdie comes to mind. I'm not sure he considers himself American, but
yeah, well, I mean, he's British, but he lives in America. I saw him once at the Museum of Modern Art. At least I think it was him. Although here's the only thing that makes me wonder if maybe I mistook him for someone else. He was wearing sweatpants. Now, the question becomes, would Salman Rushdie wear sweatpants in public?
I
don't know.
So.
He might, you know.
Especially if it were to a Yankees game.
Yeah. I also went, I did a reading one time in Seattle, and I was got there early, and I was, you know, they need you to sit somewhere, so they sat me on a couch, and then right when I got up, they were like, you know, Salman Rushdie took a nap on that couch. So that was sort of a meaningful sit. Yeah.
I love it. Well, essentially, you are a voice for people whose interests match yours, but who need you to articulate or give meaning to the subject. And the whole thing about pop culture and what is culture, what is high art versus lowbrow, high versus low, we shouldn't really concern ourselves with those categories. I mean, jazz was probably America's first cultural export. It's an art form, but it's popular.
Well, it's a complicated thing, because on the one hand, I think what you're arguing is that there's almost like a condescending view that somehow to break these into different strata,
yeah,
we're saying that, well, opera has more importance than hip hop just because we've had this pre-existing idea. I don't know if that really happens anymore, though. I now do feel as though the average person does not care about these differences between the way kind of culture is framed. However, we still use these terms sort of to explain it, I think. It's sort of like when people get very upset about, say, generation labels, millennials or Gen X or you know, the greatest generation, any of these. And what they're getting upset about is this idea that if we say someone is a member of this generation, they have all the qualities of that person. I don't think anyone believes that. However, we do need some shorthand instead of always having to say people born between 1980 and 1900. It's crazy to use the technical term. So when I say something is low culture or high culture, I don't feel like I am including that, like injecting it with this secondary meaning. To me, I'm almost sort of using it as a way for a person who is not necessarily engaged to have a sense, oh, well, he's talking about television, or he's talking about comic books or whatever, or, you know, he's talking about abstract art, or he's talking about, you know, something in between prestige television or whatever. To me, they're just ways to describe these things.
But non-judgmental.
I it would be difficult, like if, like you, when you look at my, you say like, oh, I'm somebody, people need to describe these things. I write about the popular culture, which is not things that people need. It's things people want. Okay. Like society doesn't need Beyonce. It wants Beyonce. And I would say the same thing about anything in my book. If somebody came to me and said, like, you've got to convince me that your book is essential, I would be like, you're talking about a different thing. My book is not essential. But I'm hoping that there's a certain kind of person who's like, I want this anyways. I want this not because it's critical to my existence, but then because it enriches my existence or whatever. So I don't think of myself as playing a role that's necessary. I'm ancillary. Yeah.
Well, I think you're modest, too. Let's talk about 10. It's a collection of essays, of stories, rather, that appeared in various publications, other places during the past decade. And you've described the book as a map of your interior world. Why is that different from your other writing? Isn't everything a map of your interior world?
Probably. I think what I was specifically talking about is this book, you know, it's involves stories and essays that I've written over the last 10 years or whatever. It's pretty long. It's 400 and some pages, and it has an index. And I love looking at the index of any book I've written because it is like someone has cut your skull open and your entire consciousness has been spilled out but then alphabetized. That's kind of what I mean.
I mean, it's not alphabetized.
I mean, of the 10 books, you know, I've written 2 novels. I have 2 essay collections of just all original material. I have 2 anthologies, this being the second one. And then I guess 4 standard nonfiction books. Are they all in some ways, I guess, they are, I mean, they came out of my mind, I guess, so that it would be in a way like the visual depiction of what I think about. But somehow with these stories, it almost that's almost more lucid because when I look through these stories, the main thing I remember is like, oh, I remember interviewing Jimmy Page, or I remember seeing Taylor Swift. It's like it's less like a creative project and more sort of like a reaction to what my life has just been like for the last 10 years.
Okay. Know? Well, if you're just joining us, our guest today is the pop culture essayist Chuck Klosterman. His latest book is Chuck Klosterman 10. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to City Lights on WABE.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business, committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business. And from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, presenting the season-closing concert featuring music director Robert Spano conducting Act 1 of Wagner's The Valkyrie, featuring soprano Twyla Robinson, Thursday and Saturday, June 1st and 3rd at 8 p.m. in Atlanta Symphony Hall. Tickets are available now at atlantasymphony.org or at 404-733-5000. Classical series presented by Delta Airlines.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, here with you and Chuck Klosterman. When you began your career as a reporter, your two greatest passions were sports and music. But others saw that combination of interests as peculiar. How do people, and I guess millennials especially, interact differently now with sports and culture than when you started out?
Well, you know, something happened during the 90s, which I didn't even realize until it was already over. But when I graduated from college in 1994, I went to the University of North Dakota. I majored in journalism. And at least within the institution of newspapers and of magazines, there was a real chasm between writing about sports, writing about popular culture, and writing about news. There could be some interplay between news and culture or news and sports, but particularly, you know, writing about rock music and writing about pro basketball and pro football were seen as completely unconnected things. And I think this kind of came out of the period of the 70s and 80s, where a lot of people who got involved with the music industry had sort of bad memories from high school of dealing with athletes. Because I think that there was a culture at that time where, you know, or at least a belief, which you see a lot like in movies from the 80s and John Hughes movies or whatever, where it's like, you know, like the jocks are beating up the, you know, the alienated.
Smart kids.
Yeah, and that was like I'm not even sure how common or real that was, but it was definitely perceived that way. So I started as a sports reporter in college, then kind of moved into news, but there was a job opening to write about entertainment when I graduated, and I got that job. It was a job in Fargo, and I was very fortunate to get this job despite having, you know, I was really into entertainment, but I hadn't written that much about it. But then I didn't write about sports for many years, and I don't think I would have been given the opportunity to do so. But when that decade ended and I started moving into like the world of magazines after my first book had come out, I just started writing about sports and entertainment at the same time. And no one seemed to think it was odd because that barrier ended in the 90s. And I think the biggest reason why probably was the sort of the ascension of hip-hop culture, because rappers were so often either associated with or just literally friends with athletes that started to spill over. You would see MC Hammer at a Falcons game or whatever. That became a common thing. And even some
Spike
people.
Spike Lee at a Knicks game.
Yes, yes. And even like indie rock musicians started to sort of almost at first comically, but then just sort of pragmatically expressed. You know, Stephen Malkmus would talk about his interest in basketball and all of these things. So during that period, that wall sort of disappeared. So now I think that young people almost feel an obligation to know about sports, even if they're not naturally interested in it. I gave a reading, so I'm on this book tour now. I was in Milwaukee a couple nights ago, and one guy in the audience kind of raised his hand, had a question, and he was like, you know, I don't like sports, he began saying. But he was like, but now it's cool to like sports. So he basically asked me, how do I pretend to act like I like sports? And that's a new problem that
really
did not exist 10 years ago.
Well, do you think maybe your writing helped that, helped younger people reach that?
If it played a role, it played a small role, but if it played any role, I would be happy. You know, because it's, you obviously can't go into writing with this idea that your hope is that the culture will shift because of it. You'd have to just be an insane egomaniac to think that somehow you're going to do something, sitting at a computer by yourself in a dark room, and the manifestation of that is going to make the world different. I would never think that, but, you know.
Well, that's heartening to know you are not an insane egomaniac, but I think it has helped. I also think a consequence has been that maybe we are regarding athletes as more intelligent than they're typically giving credit. I mean, there are a lot of really smart athletes who do a lot of good things, and you know, they're almost self-conscious about that. But anyway, wanted to get on, speaking of sports, Bill Simmons,
uh-huh.
and wanted to ask you, because many of the stories in 10 came from Grantland when Bill Simmons was there. How did you two first connect and then become working partners?
Well, I had two books out at the time, and in my second book, which was an essay collection called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, there was an essay about looking at the rivalry between the Celtics and the Lakers in the 80s as sort of a prism to understand everything in life. It was almost like, well, this is kind of true but also kind of ridiculous, but I'm going to write it as if this is almost common sense. And I suspect that he had read that essay. Okay, this is around 2003 or whatever. Because at one point then, he asked me, this was before podcasting, but he got in contact with me maybe through some extension of publishing. It was almost like a setup deal. Like it wasn't like we ran into each other at a party. Okay. But he asked me to do this thing where we basically emailed back and forth for 2 days, and then the entire exchange ran on ESPN. And it was pretty popular. And then he moved into podcasting, so I would be a guest on his podcast, and it is a unique deal because many people assumed we were very close friends because our chemistry, when we do that stuff, is pretty good and pretty natural. But we had no relationship outside of this. I had met him one other time, like we went to a bar, but also he had, you know, Bill's a pretty famous guy. He invited Malcolm Gladwell, so it was the three of us at this bar. So it kind of felt like I was on a panel, but there was no audience. Like, it didn't seem like a natural hanging out situation. It seemed very weird to me. And then around 2000, and I guess it would have been 9 or 10, Bill contacted me and asked me if I wanted to watch an NBA title game between the Celtics and the Lakers in Boston. And I thought that was a little curious because I thought, like, well, maybe he is trying to become friends now. We've known each other professionally for 8 years or whatever. Maybe he just had a friend back out at the last minute. Maybe he was paying me back for being on this podcast. But I take the train down there, and then before the game, we have dinner, and he's like, look, this is what I want to do. I want to launch this site, and I want you to be involved with it. And then we just started talking about the idea of that. And then while working together, we kind of did become pretty close, you know, because we were just, you know, figuring out who we're going to hire and all of these things. It took a long time. So that's how that happened. I mean, it's one of those deals where we have a lot of audience overlap. Like, a lot of people who read his books, read my books or whatever, were actually pretty different people, but the subjects we're interested in are similar, even if we think about them in totally different ways. So it works good, you know?
Oh, it works very well. And I guess that was my next question was, has collaborating with Bill Simmons on his podcast and website expanded or changed the audiences for your work?
I would say both. I mean, because whenever you expand an audience for anything, you sort of move it away from people who are drawn to the specific thing you're doing to more of the abstract thing you're doing. In other words, I think the people who initially were reading my books were a specific kind of person who maybe was very similar to me in a lot of ways. But Simmons' audience is much, much greater. In fact, I would argue that he is the most popular writer in America. And people always think that's strange. They'll be like, what about Jonathan Franzen or, you know. But the thing is, Bill appeals to people who might not have any other relationship with literature. Like, who might, you know, like they are into what he does. So this is a huge, huge, huge audience. It probably has, in some ways, helped me sell more books. I suppose maybe in another way, it has made me perceived as less of a conventional literary figure and more of just like a celebrity figure. So I have mixed feelings about mm-hmm. that. But I mean, it's been more good than bad on balance, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Our guest today is the author and essayist Chuck Klosterman. His latest book is Chuck Klosterman 10. We'll be back in just a moment on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from the Decatur Arts Festival, presented by South Walton, Florida. Over 150 visual artists and featuring theater, comedy, improv, and music on the bandstand. DecaturArtsFestival.com.
We're back with Chuck Klosterman on City Lights. He's here to talk about his new book, 10. He'll speak at the Decatur Public Library this evening about the book, part of the Georgia Center for the Book Literary Initiative. A part of 10 I especially liked was the section, I Will Choose Free Will, in which you wrote about the four best TV shows of what was then the past 10 years. You wrote this in 2011. Why do you think people who might hold back opinions on other subjects think they're experts when it comes to commenting about TV?
Well, that's a good question, because what I'm kind of discussing was there've kind of been two golden periods of television. There was the initial golden age of television, but that was more a reflection of just that we suddenly had this technology and we could do something that had never existed before. The idea of what was on TV in that seminal period, that was its mere existence sort of gave it meaning. The second one came really starting with The Sopranos, and either we're still in it now or kind of drawing to the close of it, this period where the quality of television just took sort of a dramatic leap. And you started seeing shows like, you know, The Wire and Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and some of these programs where they – initially were, you know, the big compliment was, well, these are as good as films now. And now you could almost make the argument they're better than films in a lot of ways. Well, because the depth of character is so much greater when you have all these episodes. Talking about television with people, though, is an interesting thing because it is maybe the art form people feel that they have the most sort of personal investment with. Because even though it is something that can be experienced by everyone simultaneously, it's happening in their house. So it's a very intimate thing. And yet at the same time, there's the cognitive realization that this intimate thing they're experiencing in their house is a shared experience, that they know other people are having this same feeling. So there is almost like a dissonance that they're seeing something that in part of them feels as though they have complete ownership over, and another part of them that's like, well, this is falling into, you know, a collective argument about what's good and what's bad. And people will become emotional about television in a way that you don't really see with too often with, say, like visual art. Mm-hmm. There was a time maybe in the late 60s and the 70s and 80s where that was the case with popular music. That was sort of the role pop music played then. Now TV takes that role. So when you criticize someone's television, you know, favorite television show, even if you're saying, you know, I love The Wire, but the only thing they hear is that but, and they take it almost as a personal criticism of not just their taste, but sort of their entire aesthetic worldview. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So in that article, you said, I mean, your four favorite were The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad, you thought, was the ultimate. In the years since you wrote that, what do you think the best shows are on TV?
Well, The reason I argued that Breaking Bad was the best of those four wasn't even so much an argument over its entertainment value, because all four of those are very good programs. But the thing that I thought was interesting about it was the only one of those four shows that suggested that morality was flexible. I mean, like, you look at a show like The Sopranos, you go right into it knowing this is a show about members of the mafia. So if you like a character, you're still accepting he's a criminal. If you love Tony Soprano, you know he's a murderer. You just kind of accept that that's his job. If you look at a show like Mad Men, it's set in the 60s. So anything a character does that's problematic, we just say, well, that's how it was at the time. You know, that's a reflection of how the culture had not yet evolved or whatever. you take The Wire. The Wire was a show where it was very political, and the idea was that morality is really sociological, that the cops and the drug dealers are really the same people. It's just what part of life they grew up in.
And I still have not gotten over Wallace's death.
Well, no spoilers. Oh, if someone's watching this. No. That was a great program, but also that, and in some ways, was more realistic because what it was essentially arguing was that the ethics you have or the morality you have, that's just really it is dictated by things beyond your control. But Breaking Bad was the only one of those shows where it starts with a character who's wholly good and ends with a character, the same character, being an absolute villain. So what you're really looking at is the evolution of a person choosing to be immoral, and at what point, as an audience member, are you going to say, I no longer side with him? That was the question you just didn't see in those other three shows, because the other three shows made it seem like ethics were fixed, and that was the only show where it was pliable. So I thought in that way, it was a pretty big leap narrative-wise. Like, that was an idea I had never seen in television before, where a character who's beloved was consciously made bad. Now, are you saying in the time since then, what shows? I think the best written show on TV now is probably Veep.
I agree.
I think the writing on that show is incredible. I think that the series Fargo on FX is better than the film Fargo. And I think Better Call Saul is surprisingly almost equal to Breaking Bad. Not quite, because there seems to be less at stake. And you sort of know, like, because it's a prequel, we know that, like, Saul can't die or whatever, you know. But so I would say those are my favorite shows. Now, you know, I was going to say, has anyone ever mentioned you bear a strong resemblance to someone? Amy Sedaris.
Has anyone ever told?
Well, has anyone ever told you that they remind you of Amy Sedaris?
No, but when she was in the lobby, she admired my shoes several years ago, and I didn't take them off for
weeks.
That's
the first thing I thought when I came in here, is that you look like her, and you kind of have her like her persona.
Oh, thank you, Chuck, because I think she's brilliant. And Tina Fey. Okay, can we overlook 30 Rock?
Oh, well, that was another incredibly well-written show. Apparently, there's a new show on, it's a newsroom-based show. I haven't seen it yet, but I guess it's supposed to be similar to 30 Rock, and I haven't seen it yet.
And Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah. Yes, I watched that as well. She's a very likable character.
Oh, God, I love them all. But, you know, when you mentioned ethics, of course, I'm thinking how maybe your perception of those shows was or somehow entwined with the period you spent the ethicist.
It totally was. I mean, really, if you look at all 10 of my books, I would say that you can sort of see what was happening in my life based on what the book is about. And there was just this period of my life where I was being the ethicist. I wrote, you know, that book, I Wear the Black Hat, that was about morality, and I wrote a column like that. I mean, I'm not even conscious of it at the time. Like, I would never, if you would have asked me that question then, I would have been like, oh, it's just coincidental. But now looking back, I realize that all you can do when you're a writer, basically, is write about what you are intellectually experiencing at that time. And then when you look back on it, you realize that, you know, you were just fixated on something and you didn't realize. And everything I did, I guess, during that, you know, that's when I was starting, we were going to have kids and all these things. So I was probably thinking about that stuff too. I just think that's what was going on. Yes.
Yeah. I was eager to ask you about that. In Killing Yourself to Live, you wrote a lot about love and death, especially about the latter and your obsession with death. And now in 10, you have a different perspective. How has being a father changed your outlook?
Well, you know, pretty profoundly, I guess. And I'm still surprised by how many of the cliches about parenting proved to be absolutely true. I will say, for a while, I kind of thought people were lying. When I didn't have kids, and they would basically describe their life like it was horrible, and yet they've never been happier. And I was like, well, how can that be? That makes no sense. But now I completely understand what that means. You know, what that I have never been happier in my life, and yet were I to describe it to anyone compared to my life when I was 33, they would be like, are you crazy? Because my life when I was 33 was nothing but pretty much having fun, looking for interesting things, partying, that's all it was, and working and making tons of money that was all for me. And now, like, my life is totally different, and yet it's much more satisfying. Now, how will that affect me as a writer? That's a more dangerous question, because, you know, to write about the popular culture, you really have to almost take it more seriously than it warrants in a way. You have to watch a program and be like, well, I'm going to write about this television show as if the future depends on my perception of it. That's more difficult to do for me now, because my life has sort of shifted from only looking for interesting things to embracing practical things. Like, when I think of my kid's life, like my son's three, you know, I'm interested in him. But, you know, if he gets in trouble or something, I'm not like, well, it's interesting that he chose to, you know, throw a cat out a window. I would never be that way. I would be like, the practical thing is, don't do that. Have a good life. Cats matter, or whatever, you know. As a practical person, I sometimes fear, will it be harder to write about the completely impractical world of, you know, reggae music or whatever? But I just got to try and do it, and maybe I'll have a better insight. I don't know. I mean, my son's three and my daughter's one, so I'm really just into this now. Like, I'm really sort of in the heart of having your kid's life be your life, but yeah.
I look forward to your writing about kids, and maybe you'll even venture into writing for kids.
Well, I don't know about that. I have, you know, my publisher would love for me to write a book about parenting, but I don't want to do it. And I kind of say, like, if I ever write a book about being a parent, that means I ran out of ideas. Because the thing is, that's a real safe way. If you write about parenting, it's something everyone can. But, like, I think that I'm not going to do that unless, you know, like, I have no other option. I want to keep writing the way I'm doing now, you know.
No one will be disappointed that way. This may have been really passing. I mean, just a passing reference for you, Chuck. But in 2012, you wrote this hilarious piece about drinking Mountain Dew for 25 years. And there's a reference you make to Atlanta about eating a napkin in a dark movie theater. Did you remember that before you came here?
Yeah, when I do this, like when I read tonight, this is the section I read. That's true. In North Dakota's a pretty rural place, right? The movie theaters, they never had hot dogs like at the movie theater. So I went to see Days of Thunder when I was here. My sister was living in Marietta, Georgia with her with her husband, okay? And she got into Iowa's graduate program. So I'm the seventh kid in my family. She's 18 years older than me. But they needed me to drive their car from Atlanta to Iowa as the whole kind of family moved. And I'd never been anywhere, so I fly to Atlanta and so I'm there for 3 weeks, though, and I go to this movie that's so exciting, and it's hot dogs in a movie theater. That's amazing. So I'm going in to watch Days of Thunder, and, you know, I unwrap, it's dark, I'm watching the trailer, and I unwrap the foil, and I'm eating this hot dog, and I'm like, boy, movie hot dogs are terrible. No wonder they're not popular. But then another trailer comes on, and it illuminates the whole theater, and I realize the hot dog is also wrapped in a napkin. And there was like one bite left of the hot dog. Okay.
This is your first experience visiting Atlanta.
Yes. Those 3 weeks I spent in Marriott, Marriott, Georgia, were a big deal because I had never been in it. First time I ever flew in a plane was to get down here. And my sister and her and my brother-in-law, they were still working, you know, so I would have the whole day to myself. That was a real sort of exploratory thing, you know. It's weird to... You really, I think everybody remembers the first experience they have away from their home.
You know? And here you are, a very well-traveled man in those years since. One of the most hilarious observations, I think, in the new book is this comparison you draw between your liver and Madonna. Would you explain that,
okay,
please?
Well, a few years ago, I was, you know, I was living a pretty, I guess, aggressive social life, and my liver just stopped working.
Not funny.
It was not funny. I got, well, what happened is I got mono, and then somehow that led to my liver shutting down. And, you know, I was seeing the doctor, and she was like, well, you know, just don't drink or eat any fatty foods for 6 weeks, and your liver will completely reinvent itself. And I was like, what? Like, that's all it takes. Like, my liver's not working now, but if I just don't do anything for 6 weeks, it will become a completely different liver? And she was like, yes. Well, I was pretty skeptical, but it seems to have happened. It's like, your liver is like Madonna. It can become a different person if it needs to. Like, it will just sort of follow the trends and culture and become a new organ.
And who knew?
I had no idea. I mean, it does. I guess your liver's job, though, is to just deal basically with like the worst things you ingest. So it must be a pretty hearty thing.
Love that part of the book. when did irony become your first language, or your primary language, I should say?
Seemed as though that. Here again, I guess just because this was a formative period for me, it did seem to be the 1990s, and the 80s were a more straightforward time. You look at film from the 80s, humor's pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of ironic distance between the joke and the meaning. That shifted, you know, I really think that Seinfeld played a big role in the mainstreaming of this, the idea that something like a joke without a punchline could still be funny. I think, you know, like a movie like Richard Linklater's Slacker played a role in this. You know, the music shifted away from, you know, bands like, like Motley Crue and Madonna and, you know, things like that to Nirvana and Liz Phair and this idea that these rock stars were uncomfortable, like being a rock star became something that you kind of made fun of, even if you were one, you know? And then there were books like, you know, like the popularity of Dave Eggers played a role in this, that it was this huge book that I think to people much older were like, well, I don't even understand what's the funny part about this. But for a lot of other people, that was like, this is what I want to do. You know, David Foster Wallace, even though he used to lament irony, he kind of ushered in this sense that, like, there's something funny about talking conversationally about academic ideas, and the humor is the collision of those things. So then by the time I moved to New York in 2002, what everybody was saying is the age of irony is over. Now we're in the new sincerity. And interestingly, Dave Eggers was part of that too, in some way. The belief was that now, you know, irony is trapping people. It's young people have no idea, you know, do I like Smashing Pumpkins or do I think it's funny that I like Smashing Pumpkins? I can't even tell, you know. Now I think it's probably the main way young people understand humor at all. Like, they're native to it. I think that's, you know, and maybe it'll shift back. I remember after 9/11 for a while, they were like, we'll never make jokes again, but that didn't happen.
No. Yeah. Chuck, it takes a particular mastery of metaphor to describe Prince as having a black belt in eccentricity. Yeah. I'd like to think of you as Mark Twain, if Twain liked sports, punk rock, heavy metal, Cocoa Puffs. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Well,
this has been a delight.
That's an incredibly nice thing of you to say. And, you know, if I did one thing that was as good as what Mark Twain seemed to do every day for 30 years, I guess I would be pretty happy.
Chuck Klosterman's new book is 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the 21st Century. He speaks at the Decatur Public Library, Georgia Center for the Book, this evening at 7:15. There will be details on our website at wabe.org. Bravo.